Belgic Confession, Article 36. We read the whole, because it's our first class, that especially. It's entitled The Magistrates. We believe that our gracious God, because of the depravity of mankind, hath appointed kings, princes, and magistrates, willing that the world should be governed by certain laws and policies, to the end that the dissoluteness of men might be restrained, and all things carried on among them with good order and decency. For this purpose he hath invested the magistracy with the sword, for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. Their office is not only to have regard unto and watch for the welfare of the civil state, but also that they protect the sacred ministry, and thus may remove and prevent all idolatry and false worship. The kingdom of Antichrist may be thus destroyed, and the kingdom of Christ promoted. They must therefore countenance the preaching of the word of the gospel everywhere, that God may be honored and worshipped by everyone as he commands in his word. Moreover, it is the bounden duty of everyone, of what state, quality, or condition soever he may be, to subject himself to the magistrates, to pay tribute, to show due honor and respect to them, and to obey them in all things which are not repugnant to the word of God, to supplicate for them in their prayers, that God may rule and guide them in all their ways, and that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. Wherefore we detest the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people, and in general all those who reject the higher powers and magistrates, and would subvert justice, introduce a community of goods, and confound that decency and good order which God hath established among men. Let me begin by drawing your attention to four notable features of Belgic Confession 36. First, it is the penultimate article in the Belgic Confession. And the penultimate means the one before the last. Now, this means that we only have one more article after this one. Belgic Confession 37 on the end times. And so we're getting nearer the end of our classes on the Belgic Confession. Second, Belgic Confession 36 is the most political article in the Belgic Confessions or anywhere in our creedal heritage. It's entitled The Magistrates. Its subject is the civil government, including laws, capital punishment, taxes, communism, etc., all political issues. And it's a good time to be dealing with the confessional and biblical teaching on political issues, because we're in the middle of Brexit. And there is coming a general election on the 12th of December 2019. So we have about a month and a week. The penultimate article, the most political article. And third, Belgic Confession 36 is the only footnoted article in the Belgic Confession or in our creedal heritage. When I say it's the only footnoted article, I certainly mean at least our edition of it. There are other editions by other churches which may not have a footnote. There are no footnotes in Belgic Confession 1 all the way to Belgic Confession 35, or Belgic Confession 37, or in our Canons of Dort, or Heidelberg Catechism. It's just Belgic Confession 36. It has a footnote indicating disagreement with part of the second paragraph of the article. There are four paragraphs. And the footnote is lengthy. The footnote in the Green Book. It's found on page 74. The footnote has two paragraphs, two lengthy paragraphs, and it may actually contain more words than Belgic Confession 36 itself. Do we have anyone here who's willing to do a bit of counting? You can use, you know, both hands, or you can jot them down, or any way you want. If someone would be willing, or you could go online and copy and paste and then do a word count, both the footnote and the other four. I'm curious which is the longest, because it looks to me as if the footnote, which is in small print, actually has more words in it, but we await an official authoritative adjudication on that issue. Right, Belgic Confession number 4 regarding Article 36. It is, and this may be the thing that you thought of first of all regarding this article, it is the most controversial article of the Belgic Confession. It's the most controversial article in part because of number 2. It's the most political article, and once you bring up politics, you're almost immediately into controversy. And once you deal with a footnote, you know, you're into controversial issues. And this article is controversial, was controversial even when it was written. Now, I'm not talking about a controversy within the Reformed, but it was controversial when it was written with respect to its adversaries. If you look at paragraph 2, there's a beautiful phrase there, the kingdom of Antichrist. And the people who wrote it and read it on the Reformed side and on the Roman Catholic side all knew what was intended there. They meant the dominion of the Pope. And they don't care to be called the kingdom of Antichrist. Paragraph 4 says, we detest the error of the Anabaptists and other seditious people. So here opponents are named, which isn't always or often or usually the case. This was controversial when written. Then we add to this that Article 36 has been controversial in the history of the Reformed churches themselves. Not just the opponents at the time and since, but in the Reformed churches themselves. And we'll say more about this at a later time. And this, of course, is evident, especially in the footnote, in the content of the footnote, which explains something of the controversy, and in its inclusion as a footnote too. But not only at the start with its opponents, and in the history of the Reformed churches, but this article is controversial now and in our own circles. Not everyone in the Protestant Reformed churches, our sister church, has exactly the same view regarding church and state, etc., the issues that crop up in the second paragraph or the reading of the footnote. They differ among themselves. Some of them do. And it may be the case that there are differences in this room with people in the CPRC. And not just people in this room, but I may well get emails or perhaps even phone calls or letters from people who listen to these classes online or in a CD box set in the future expressing disagreement with some of what will come up in the class. And by the way, in subsequent classes, we're going to pass over briefly now, we're going to speak about how we should agree or disagree on this issue and try to assess the seriousness or not as regards disagreements on this issue. And then how much does the Bible itself say to the issue? All important questions. So four things about this article, the penultimate article. So we're getting near the end of the classes. The most political article, certainly is. The only footnoted article, and the most controversial article. Now let's summarize the contents of Belgic Confession 36. This summary is helpful if you are perhaps intimidated by this article. Boy, it says a lot of things. What's going on here? Or if you want to know basically right at the start what it covers, and if you want an idea, therefore, on the sorts of subjects that these classes are going to treat in the days ahead. So the four paragraphs. We're into fours tonight. The four paragraphs deal, first of all, with the institution of civil government. Run your eye over the first paragraph. That deals with the institution of civil government. Look at the second paragraph, the one with the footnote. The second paragraph deals with the task of civil government, what it is supposed to do. And third, the third paragraph treats our duty regarding the civil government. And then the fourth deals with the rejection of the civil government. So, the institution of civil government, it's being set up, the task, what it's supposed to do, our duty, how we're to respond to it, and then the rejection of it. Those are the subjects of the four paragraphs, respectively. Slightly differently, we could arrange these four paragraphs like this. Paragraph 1, where does the civil government come from? Paragraph 2, what is its calling? Paragraph 3, well, we've seen what its calling is. What's our calling towards the civil government? It is a job to do. We have a response. And then fourth, and this reflects back on all the three previous paragraphs, the fourth paragraph says, therefore we detest the error of the Anabaptists, or at least some of the Anabaptists, who reject the teaching of the previous three paragraphs dealing with the institution of civil government, the duty of the civil government, and our response and submission to the civil government. Is everybody happy with that so far? Tibor.
Is the footnote also part of the CPRC's confession, or only the PRC confession?
The CPRC has adopted the footnote. But we're not going to get much into the footnote or its interpretation or the range of interpretations tonight. There's controversy coming. But the first paragraph isn't controversial. The third paragraph isn't controversial. The fourth one isn't, or at least not in our circles terribly. And then we can deal with... Sorry, I said then, as if we're going to deal with it in that order. I haven't decided that. But then we can address the issues of the footnote. Now, let's speak about the various forms and spheres of government among human beings. And I say this, we're not just going to talk now about civil government. I say this because of the willful ignorance of people today and a sloppy, or at least imprecise, use of language. Often today, people will talk about the government. And I don't mean to say that it's wrong to talk about the government, and that you understand it means the civil government. It almost always, or always, means the civil government. And that's imprecise, although we all know what it's referring to, but it's imprecise and probably, for many people, misleading. Think now of secular society and the way most people think, sadly, in our own day. It's as if the other governments don't exist, or at least they don't really matter. What about God's government? His providential rule over all things? Let's talk about that. If one thing has a right to be called the government, it's God's government of absolutely everything under the heavens and even in the heavens. Men, angels, civil governments, every thought, there's government. Not just laws in the statute book and putting a few people through the courts and into prison. And then what about the other governments among humanity? The government is basically just the state. And for many people, that's they don't really think about the other governments. I think that's a true statement regarding many people. And so this notion, whether intentionally or not, it proceeds from and leads to an unhealthy view of civil government whereby, you know, it is the government. Well, then it invariably, or almost invariably, encroaches upon other spheres of human government. And it takes too much authority upon itself, and thereby it oppresses its people. And given sin, this is what invariably has happened in many places and many ages, and you can see it with many governments around the world right now. And we're going to look at that in later classes too. So let's remind ourselves of other forms, other important forms too, of human governments and their own spheres besides civil government. First of all, we have church government. Church government. The government, okay, the civil government. It's the language I prefer to use, although I'm sure I probably use the phrase the government too, because in part it's a shortening. But what about church government? And the very truth of church government is that government ordained by Christ with its own sphere ought to make, ought to make the state think, I oughtn't be intruding in there. Church government. Now, where do we read most about church government in our major and minor confessions? In our major confessions, we read most about church government in the Belgic Confession. Articles 27 through 35, the preceding nine articles deal with church government, especially Article 30, the government of and offices in the church, the government of the church. Article 31, the ministers, elders, and deacons. Article 32, the order and discipline of the church. And the other articles, when they deal with the necessity of membership in the church, there's authority and government in the church, the marks of the church, and the sacraments of the church. The church has authority in Christ's name to govern the administration of the sacraments. In our minor confessions, where do we read most about the government of the church? So you have a choice here, about 1 in 10 or 12. The form for the ordination of elders or deacons or ministers is a fair bit to say about it, but the best answer is the church order. The church order is a manual of the government of the church. Besides civil government, I've mentioned here church government, and then we have family government. And family government could be divided into the husband's headship over his wife, symbolizing the relationship between Christ and his church, love and submission, and the parents' leadership over their children. And if we're going to talk creedally about the husband's headship over his wife, where are we going to go for that?
Marriage
for. And if we're going to talk about parents' headship over their children, where would we go for that?
Baptism.
Yes, the baptismal form. Then we have individual government. And the Christian is a prophet and a priest, and now especially a king, and he rules over himself under Jesus Christ and according to the word and by the power of the Holy Spirit. That's really important. Individual government, you've got to be in control of yourself. And even the non-Christian, he's a citizen and he has personal responsibility. So you hear this about the government. Now, you can imagine yourself being interviewed down the street. Sir, do you have time to take a few questions? What is your thinking about the government? And you're going to be broadcast on ITN or ITV. And you say, oh, the government. Which government do you mean? Stare at you. So do you mean my personal government of myself? Do you mean family government? Do you mean church government? Do you mean God's government of the whole world? Just be amazed. Say, well, there are all these other governments, and they all have their separate spheres. And we need to behave in each sphere in accordance with that sphere. And the spheres oughtn't to encroach upon each other, because then you end up with tyranny. Cut. We don't want to hear this. All I was asking you was, who do you think's going to win the general election? And you give me a theological lecture. Well, sir, I thought a theological lecture would do you more good. We could talk, too, about business government. Business government, which is dealt with in Ephesians 6, verses 5 through 9. Here it deals in the original with slaves and masters. How are Christians to work within that system? Not a very attractive system, but how are they to work? And then by extension, servants to their masters, or employers to employees, the basic spiritual issues that are involved in that. And Colossians 3 verses 22 through 4 verse 1 deal with that too. Now, I'm not going to flash it out now. There are later classes coming. But you should be able to understand the wickedness and the misery which ensues when the state overreaches itself, and you can understand the difficulties faced by Christians. Think of the tyranny, for instance, in Islamic lands, where the church has to go through all, jump through all sorts of hoops, even to get an extension on its, to its church building. And I better stop there because we're encroaching on later material. But here we need to clarify just a little the church and the civil government. The state has a right to make laws which affect the church, such as
giving. I mean, tax relief on giving, that's just one thing.
Yes. If the state wants to give tax relief to offerings, it's free to do that. We take advantage of that situation, yeah?
And such as building controls.
Building controls. Health and safety. We have fire extinguishers there. It's a law that you need them for public buildings. And that's a reasonable demand of the state, and that doesn't impinge upon the witness of the church or the three marks. But there are other things that the state must not, and God will hold them accountable for it and punish them fiercely for it. They must not pass other laws, such as requiring churches to perform homosexual marriages. The state has no right to do that whatsoever. So there are some things which are within its sphere, and the church had better do those things which are within its sphere. But there are other things that it has no right to do whatsoever. And at that point, the state turns into a beast. A wild, rampaging, nasty beast. And then we can talk about the intrusion of the state into other areas, the intrusion of the state into family government. For instance, the named person scheme in Scotland, which has failed and which cost a lot of money for Christians and other concerned groups to oppose. The idea that the state would appoint a guardian over every child in Scotland, with the guardian having greater rights than the parents of the child, is an assault upon family government and a gross abuse and wickedness of the state. That's tyranny, and that puts unfair fear, and it would have, into the hearts of parents. But the state has other things to say regarding, you know, family government. If the state realises that there's some child is being abused or not being fed properly, the state can interfere there. With regard to an individual government, we wouldn't want the state to pass a law that every citizen has to brush his teeth first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And if at all possible, if you remember during the middle of the day, these things might be good ideas, and they're, and parents have the right to tell their children that. But we wouldn't want the state to bring in a law like that. And I mentioned one that's frivolous. I couldn't imagine any state doing that. But it's just an amusing sort of example of, you know, that's not its job to do that. Parents can do that. And if the state decided that every individual had to brush their teeth too, even if they're adults, well, that would be an infringement in the legitimate self-government of the citizen. With regard to the state's involvement in business, the state can say you must pay your taxes. You mustn't impose upon your employees dangerous or degrading work conditions. Those are all reasonable things. But to give examples, we'll say going back to the Second World War, the state can't come in and say, we have a number of Jews here from the concentration camp and we require them to work for you, and like IG Farben and so forth. And the state's no right to do that. Now, wherein lies the unity of these various types of human governments? Think of this in connection with the Ten Commandments, and one of the Ten Commandments. Which of the Ten Commandments emphasizes the unity between all these different sorts of governments?
The fifth.
The fifth commandment. Brian is pleading the fifth. It's the fifth commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Let's turn to Lord's Day 39. The Heidelberg Catechism's explanation of the fifth commandment. Lord's Day 39 says, what doth God require in the fifth commandment? That I show all honour, love and fidelity to my father and mother, and all in authority over me, which would include a husband, or office bearers in the church, your employer, and the civil government. And then it goes on to say, submit myself to their good instruction and correction with due obedience, patiently bear with their weaknesses and infirmities, since it pleases God to govern us by their hand. So all types of human governments, civil, ecclesiastical, familial, individual, business, all types of human governments are under the divine government. He sets the rules. He legislates. He rules providentially. He judges. He punishes. There's the real government. But ungodly man says we will not have Christ to rule over us. All types of human governments, they're under the divine government and they originate in God's authority. God gives them the right to do what they do and laws to govern their behavior. This key truth is vital regarding all thinking and especially the state. So if the state, and there is a sort of a natural humility too, so if the state carries itself with some measure of humility and not arrogance, knowing that it is not the supreme, that the civil government is not the be-all and end-all. God is. He rules. Humility. And then second, the state ought to be aware too of its limitations, that it is not totalitarian. And totalitarian is a long word, but you can guess the root of it. What's the root of the basic block of total? A totalitarian state is a state where the civil magistrate has total control over your life and shapes and governs you in all sorts of ways. And the Antichrist's kingdom is a totalitarian state. You'll not be able to buy and sell without the mark of the beast. One giant worldwide kingdom in which all citizens are forced, on pain of death, to deny Jesus Christ and to worship the image. So this truth about all the authority coming from God and laws over the various spheres and the encroachment of one sphere upon another being unlawful, this limits the state. So it's not the government. It's one government under God, with under various divine laws, and with other governments having their place and function. Now let's talk about different forms of civil government. I'm going to mention five words here. The first of these is monarchy. Monarchy. And the archy bit comes from a Greek word meaning rule. So who rules in a monarchy? A king or a queen. And monarchy means one rule, one person rules, and is understood to refer to royalty. That's monarchy. What about oligarchy? Again, you see the archy bit. Oligarchy is the rule of...
family.
Nope.
One person supported by a few others. You prop them up.
It's the rule of a few, from the Greek oligos, which is a few. And Geneva in Calvin's day was an oligarchy. Rule of a few. Then we have democracy. And the crassy bit comes from kratos, meaning power or strength. Archy means rule, but it's basically the same thing. It's the rule of the demos. The rule of
people.
The rule of the people, which means, in most instances, the rule of the majority of the people. And much of the world today consists of democracies in various shapes and forms. Here's one, plutocracy. This is how Hollywood is reigned, is ruled, by Pluto the dog. See? Or else it's the rule of the planet Pluto. No?
No.
Nobody's buying that.
Rich person.
What's that?
Rich person.
The rich people. A plutocracy is the rule of the rich. And it's usually a pejorative term. So, you know, the plutocracy. You're thinking of people like George Soros. You know, that's the sort of thing there. And then, of course, we have anarchy. An anarchy.
No government.
Anarchy is the rule of the classroom by the students. Yeah. No rule. The A, privative. No rule. As Calvin famously said, people behave then like rats in the straw. And of them all, the worst one is anarchy. Anarchy is the worst. You see that, for instance, with Iraq. You know, Saddam Hussein, by anybody's reckoning, wouldn't have gotten 10 out of 10 according to being a good ruler. But when society broke down, there were people who said, bring back the good old days when we had Saddam ruling over us. Though that isn't to say that you can get beyond those bad days to something that's better than Mr. Hussein. Now, besides, those are just five significant words. Besides other forms of government, there are all sorts of variations within these. Let's pick a couple of these. Monarchy and democracy. Two of the most influential currently, or at least in recent, relatively recent history. So you can have a monarchy which is absolute, an absolute monarch, such as
Charles the First.
Sorry?
Charles the First.
Charles the First.
Yeah.
Yes, and Charles the First, who ended up being beheaded in 1640. What's that?
49.
That's exactly it. He was charged as being an absolute monarch, but he wouldn't have been as absolute a monarch as King Louis the 14th, the Sun King. So here we do have varying degrees of absoluteness in an absolute monarch. So it isn't absolutely absolute. So we have an absolute monarch, and then if someone has the power of an absolute monarch but isn't a king, we typically don't call them an absolute monarch as a monarch. We call them dictators, like Stalin or Kim Jong-un or Mao Zedong or Hitler. And then, so on the one hand, we have an absolute monarch, and then we have a constitutional monarch. And a constitutional monarch is a monarch who is governed by the Constitution, which severely limits him or her. And the UK has had a constitutional monarch, especially from really William III onwards. That was part of, you know, you can become king now over Great Britain and Ireland. But you've got to work hand in hand with Parliament. So there's monarchy on the one hand, absolute and constitutional. So our monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, is a constitutional monarch. She has important civil roles, but she doesn't rule the country. She's the ruler, she's the monarch, but in terms of real power and authority, she doesn't rule. It doesn't mean she shouldn't be afforded respect. Then we have democracy, and we could talk on the one hand of a pure democracy. Anyone know what a pure democracy is?
I think there is one.
You don't think there is one? You think they're all impure democracies? Well, democracy means the rule of the people. So if you have a relatively small state that doesn't encompass too big an area, you can make civil decisions with everyone voting, like happened in parts of Greece in ancient days. But they didn't allow the women to vote, and they didn't allow slaves to vote. So even then, it wasn't exactly a pure democracy. So in any decision then, everybody has to come to the public place. They would discuss it, and then they would vote. So that's a pure democracy. And then there's what we have, a parliamentary democracy. So the people vote, and then their representatives go to Parliament, and then they cast their votes there. Which is a good job, because how many people do you think is in the UK at the minute? 62 million or something?
Something like that.
And even if under 18s couldn't vote, I don't know if the bus system and the train system could handle everyone coming up for every national issue to London to have a vote. So parliamentary democracy. And then with parliamentary democracy, you can have one chamber or two chambers. Like in the UK, you have the House of Lords and the House of the Commons. Or in the US, you have the Senate and the House of Representatives. Now, let's talk then about the head of state. The head of state. The head of state in the UK is the Queen, constitutionally. But politically, the most power rests with the Prime Minister. The head of state in Germany, what's that person called? The Chancellor. In the US, the head of state is the President. In Saudi Arabia,
it's going to be
the King. In the Vatican City, it's the Pope. He is the head of state, and he functions like a king. A pretty absolute sort of monarch. Now, there is the question as to which is the best form of government. Some of them are on the board there. There are, of course, others. What was the view of John Calvin, the best form of government?
Oligarchy.
An oligarchy, which just so happened to be what they had in Geneva. And I'm sure that the members of those two bodies, it was the Council of the 25 and whatever the one was, can't just recall now. Would have read that page of the Institute and said, good man, Calvin. Good. Can anyone recall what Winston Churchill famously said about the best form of government?
Democracy, just we don't have a better one.
Yes. He said that democracy, by which he didn't mean pure democracy, he meant parliamentary democracy. He said democracy is the worst form of civil government apart from all the rest. And his point was, and it was a very good point, because of what you're working with, not that he believed in total depravity, but he believed that there was a basic problem and flaw to mankind. There is no system that is perfect. And every system is open to abuse. So he said it's the worst form of civil government apart from all the rest. There are some people, including some Christians, they would say the best form of government is
Theocracy.
A theocracy. Well, there are some who would say. I was going to say there are some people who are Christians, and kind of some even around here, who say the best form of government is a benevolent dictator. Because let's assume the dictator is a Christian. So you have one guy who leads, and that guy follows the Lord, and then he makes good laws. So you can see why a Christian would like a benevolent dictator. But then what happens when the benevolent dictator dies? And then the next dictator, you know, it's the problem with monarchy in general. You know, you get a good king, and then the king's son, maybe the disaster. And
right? Would Cromwell be an example of that?
Cromwell would be seen by many as a benevolent dictator, yes. Now, we're talking about disagreements and controversy. To take a very safe example, we do not have to differ on the theoretical idea as to which is the best form of government. Because the Bible doesn't say, in fact, what the Bible really is about is, you're a Christian, the powers that be are ordained of God, you work with what you've got, mate. That's really the calling of the scriptures. The creeds don't say, you know, John Calvin said an oligarchy. The Guido de Bray was mightily influenced by Calvin and was a student of his. He didn't put into his creed what he read in Calvin's Institutes that an oligarchy would be a good idea. I don't personally know what de Bray's view on that was. It wouldn't have been a wise thing for him to have said in the Spanish Netherlands at that time to advocate an oligarchy when the Habsburg emperor has you don't want to give him another ground to want you dead. But this much the creed does say. Belgic Confession 36, the second line says, I'll read the first bit as well. We believe that our gracious God, because of the depravity of mind, hath appointed kings, princes, and magistrates, civil office bearers of various sorts, willing that the world should be governed, etc. Now, what are the basic components for civil government? Belgic Confession 36, its first paragraph, mentions the three basic components for civil government. What are they?
For the punishment of evildoers.
Number one, punishment. If you're going to have a civil government, you need to have punishment. We're not in some utopia here. Man has fallen, there needs to be punishment. What else do we need for civil government that's mentioned in the first paragraph?
Laws.
Julian says laws. We need laws. Punishment is mentioned in the last sentence of the first paragraph. God has invested the magistracy with the sword for the punishment of evildoers. The third line talks about certain laws and policies. What's the other thing we need? Mari, did you have something to say?
Good order.
Sorry?
Protection.
Protection, okay. And good order. We need office bearers. Office bearers. The second line talks about kings, princes, and magistrates. And the rationale of this is simple. You need office bearers of whatever sort. Rulers, judges, policemen. You need office bearers to make the rules, to interpret the rules, and to enforce the rules. You need office bearers. And the rules are necessary in order to restrain, to use the language of the catechism, to restrain the dissolution of men and see to it that all things are done, carried out among them with good order and decency. And then punishment is necessary to vindicate the law, to afflict the criminals, and to deter other people who might be inclined to follow this vicious way of the offenders. So you need office bearers, laws, and punishment. If you have those three things which achieve the ends mentioned there, would you agree that that's the heart of it? Those are the three things you need, basically.
Yeah.
You would? Good. Brian, you took a course or two in law. Mm-hmm. That would make sense to you, that. Yep. And we see this in the church too. What is church government? You got office bearers, You've got laws and you've got punishment. So we see this too in the Belgic Confession. Let's look back at church government, right? Article 30, the government of and offices in the church. Article 31, the ministers, elders and deacons. And then for rules, Belgic Confession 32. I'll read it, the first part. In the meantime, we believe that it is useful and beneficial that those who are rulers of the church institute, think of the last two articles, rulers of the church institute and establish certain ordinances among themselves for maintaining the body of the church, yet they ought studiously to take care that they do not depart from those things which Christ, our only Master, hath instituted, and so we reject human inventions, etc., laws which man would introduce into the worship of God to bind and compel the conscience in any manner whatsoever. We only admit laws which tend to nourish and preserve concord and unity and keep all men in obedience to God. And then the article goes on, Belgian Confession 32, to talk about punishment. For this purpose, excommunication or church discipline is requisite with the several circumstances belonging to it according to the word of God. And of course, because of the nature of church government as opposed to civil government, the word punishment is used, but well, if the person doesn't actually repent, it ultimately is punishment. But if the person, by God's grace, repents, it's only chastisement. It's good. It's always intended by the office bearers of the church and by the church itself for good. Those three things. Where you have a government, you need office bearers, you need laws, and you need to be able to have a stick. Because if you've got laws without a stick, I'm using the word stick metaphorically, then the laws won't stick. True? Yeah, true. Now, is there anything like this in the church order that says that you basically need these three things for church government? Anything like this in the church order? Now, I understand that not everybody's reading the church order as part of their bedtime reading, but what do you think?
Yeah.
Yes. The very first article of the Church Order, if you have the Green Creeds book, turn to page 378. 378. Here's one summary article. The very first article in the Church Order. For the maintenance of good order in the Church of Christ. That's the goal. The church must be orderly. It is necessary that there should be offices, assemblies. So offices, that's office bearers. Assemblies, that's where the office bearers come together. So that's our first point in the board. Offices, assemblies, and then supervision of doctrine, sacraments, and ceremonies according to laws. The doctrine must be governed by laws. The sacraments by laws from the Word of God. Ceremonies. And then it adds, and Christian discipline. Punishment, for want of a better word, or chastisement. And then Church Order 1 goes on to say, of which matters the following articles treat in due order. So there must be decency and an order in the church, and there needs to be decency and an order in the way in which you lay out your church order. It has to be orderly so that people can understand and follow it. Everybody happy with what we've said so far? Good. Do we have something like this, office bearers, laws and punishment, in family government with our children? The office bearers are the parents. The laws are, be in by 11 o'clock or else. And the punishment is, what sort of punishment?
You're grounded.
Grounded. There you are. Or, apparently this is the worst punishment of the lot, we'll take your smartphone from you for at least a week. That's the one that has them shaking in their boots. And you don't think they really shake at all, Brian? Else, I don't know. Anyway, then you have rules in a business, the government of a business. You have office bearers, the owner and the CEOs, and then you have laws, and then you have punishment. And logically, it all makes sense. But of course, as I said earlier, depending on the nature of the government, civil government, family government's going to operate differently. Depending on the number of the people who are governed, the laws aren't going to be as onerous, and the punishments aren't going to be as That's serious. Next time, Lord willing, we're going to look at the institution of civil government. We're going to look more thoroughly at first paragraph, Lord willing.